Hi, I'm Alana Prasad, member of the ACG Women's Committee, and I'll be the moderator for this session, Endoscopy and Sedation in Pregnancy. This is part of the ACG GI and Pregnancy Monograph Series. I'm really lucky to be joined by the two authors of the article, Dr. Isma Siddiqui, an advanced endoscopist and director of the Center for Endoscopic Research and Therapeutics at the University of Chicago, and Dr. David Heppner, an anesthesiologist and medical director of the Weiner Center for Preoperative Evaluation at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Welcome to you both, and thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, no, thank you for having us. Looking forward to a great discussion.
Great. Reading through the article, there are a lot of really salient points. I think it's easily understood by a lot of non-medical personnel, as well as doctors, but obviously particularly informative to gastroenterologists. Bearing that in mind, we'll jump right in. What are some of the concerns that we have about endoscopy in this particular population?
So the main concern is that the risk for aspiration, what happens is they have an esophageal sphincter tone that it's looser compared to the non-pregnant. The volume is the same, but that's because of the lower esophageal tone and also the intra-abdominal pressure. There may be increased risk for aspiration, but because of that, there are many medications to take, like some acids, some promotivity agents, and such as red. So that's one of those. That's probably the main one. Also, if they are after 18 to 20 weeks and left uterine displacement, sometimes you have to wet up the uterus on the aorta and vena cava, which could cause compression and then decrease blood flow to the fetus. We're always concerned about the medications that we used. During pregnancy, although most of them are pretty safe, they really don't have any teratogenic potential, but we try to avoid giving these medications if possible during the first trimester. Other things is like the airway may be more difficult. There could be some swelling of the airway. So we probably want to be careful if the plan is to go very deep, not trying to intubate. So we try to stay away from intubation. Then there's also some physiological anemia of pregnancy. But those, what I mentioned, are probably the most salient physiological changes that are important to take into account when giving sedation and doing an endoscopic procedure.
If you take a step back and just think that, you know, every year in the U.S., there are over 20,000 endoscopies performed on pregnant women, and the vast majority are going to be performed safely because, as Dr. Heppner mentioned, I think we're just aware that there are some specific physiologic differences between a pregnant and non-pregnant patient, that as long as you have two things, a good indication and a good discussion, you know, between GI, anesthesia, and the OB-GYN doctors, you know, these things can be performed quite safely.
For regular general GI procedures, do you feel that we need to modify the procedures at all, like for regular endos and colons and things?
I think the main things, again, make sure you're going in for a good reason. Usually, I think for general GI procedures, that might be GI bleeding that needs potentially an intervention. So, you know, in terms of the sedation, we have our anesthesia colleagues who can look at that. In terms of the procedure itself, you know, left lateral position is a favorable one for pregnant patients in general. And also just trying to be very efficient with your time. When we're doing ERCP, we also try to limit fluoroscopic imaging to reduce radiation exposure. But with your procedure in general, you should do it like you would in any other patient, but just with those other considerations on sedation, positioning, and just being very efficient, I think, to limit the amount of sedation that needs to be given.
And as a segue to that, elective cases should be done after pregnancy. Urgent cases, you have to do anything urgent, you do it. And non-emergent, but not elective cases, ideally, if possible, the second trimester, just because you're past the formation of the organs, organogenesis, and also later on, there could be some preterm labor, the uterus may interfere with the area. So ideally, beginning of the second trimester.
You know, if a pregnant patient does need endoscopy, you know, she might be concerned, oh, is this procedure going to endanger, you know, my baby in any way? Is there any data to show that endoscopy is harmful for fetus?
I mean, again, it can be performed quite safely. And Dr. Heppner can get into the sedation or medications that are chosen in a pregnant patient over a non-pregnant patient. But for the most part, it definitely can be performed safely.
So for the most part, most of the medications used do not have an effect on the organogenesis and the formation of the organs or any damage to the fetus. Ideally, we avoid the first trimester because of the potential concern, but it really hasn't been demonstrated. What we all say, the obstetric anesthesiologist, is that the management of the case is much more important than the medication. So we want to avoid that decrease in the blood pressure, avoid decrease in the oxygen, avoid, if the patient is intubated, avoid ventilating too fast. So just watching the hemodynamic parameters is much more important.
And so getting into, you guys have already kind of segued into more like some of the specifics, but prophylaxis, is there any special prophylaxis needed for these patients?
So with them, to give, especially if they're past the first trimester, we give some antacid. We give bromocriptyline agents such as Regnan. And sometimes we also give some of the H2 blockers, such as ranitidine, which also help with the motility.
Some endoscopy procedures, we do antibiotic prophylaxis, but again, if it's a GI bleed, typically you won't need that.
And also depending, like I said, ideally we do it on the beginning of the second trimester, but if for some reason it's an urgent case that needs to be done later, usually if it's like in the late 20s or early 30s, you need to have a discussion with the obstetrician. Do they need some steroids for fetal lung maturity? And that brings me to another point, that if you go by the American College of OBGYN, anytime that a pregnant patient is having surgery, we should involve an obstetrician just because they're the experts, and be sure that they are aware that the patient is having surgery. Usually, if it's after 24 weeks, then we actually monitor tone. Usually, if the baby is viable, you want to check the fetal heart rate before, at the very least, before and after the procedure. So very, very important to be sure that either the obstetrician or a high-risk obstetrician at your institution is involved in the care of this patient.
That's how we do it in our institution. Unless there is a specific reason that you need fetal heart monitoring throughout the procedure, we always, the OB team always gets those before and then after the procedure. So that's protocol.
And for the most part, and that's an excellent point, usually for the continuous, it's usually if it's possible, like if you could do it, because if it's not possible, if it's not possible, also more than 24 weeks, because that's when you may intervene and pass a certain section. If you have, then you also need to be sure you have the resources. You cannot have the monitoring without having a nurse that is watching it continuously and an obstetrician that it's ready to do an urgent cesarean section.
All very important points. That was something I was going to ask, but you beat me to it. Yeah, what are the circumstances or the conditions where we would need to seek that additional consultation? So thank you for mentioning that. So during the course of the procedure, sometimes, you know, we might need to change patient position, or there's certain maneuvers that might be needed, giving pressure, things like that. Is that okay with these type of patients? Are there certain, you know, positions or maneuvers that we really should avoid doing?
Obviously, if a patient's supine or prone, those are probably not desirable positions for a pregnant patient, especially if you're worried about risk for aspiration. So again, I think left lateral position, trying to avoid as much, I think, manual manipulation of the abdomen, I think would definitely be advised. So in terms of those factors, you might have to just modify the way you do the procedure somewhat.
And then I feel like we might have touched on this a little bit, but just in case there was anything else that we needed to say, if a patient needs, you know, so sometimes those longer procedure, advanced procedures, ERCP. When we're thinking about additional risks or concerns, Dr. Siddiqui, you mentioned, you know, trying to keep it as brief as possible, trying to avoid fluoro as much as possible. Is there anything else to bear in mind or any additional precautions to take for those types of procedures?
I think in the past, with regard to, you know, shielding the pregnant patient, there were thoughts that you should put an additional fluoro kind of cover on the pregnant patient, but that is a myth. In fact, that might focus radiation onto the fetus even more so. So we don't do any extra kind of shielding on our usual fluoro table. We do like to have the patient left lateral. If there's not a certainty, say we're going in for a suspicion of a bile duct stone and you're not certain how many they are, if there is in fact one for sure, I think using endoscopic ultrasound, which does not involve fluoroscopy, is a nice tool because you can get a very clear picture of the anatomy and know, okay, there's one stone in the distal duct, it's small, and then you can do your ERCP a little bit more efficiently. Some people even advocate doing fluoroless ERCP. There's, you know, discussions over if that makes you more efficient or less so. But I think if you do a standard ERCP, we limit the amount of still images we take because that increases a little bit of exposure and just, again, try to do the procedure, you know, as efficiently, safely as possible.
And a very good point from the anesthesia point of view, if you're going to do an ERCP, if it's a longer procedure, if you think you need more than just mild sedation, there's always the discussion of the, do we, like I discussed it with the gastroenterologist, do we need to intubate this patient to protect their airway? It's going to last a long time. Like if I do deep sedation, I'm going to the second trimester, there's always a risk for aspiration. So securing their airway is always something that I discuss if it's going to be a long procedure.
Can I ask a question, David, now that I have you on here? But would your preference be, and I feel like our anesthesia team, the preference is to intubate just because that risk of aspiration, you know, is so feared that I feel like I don't remember doing any cases under MAC, but mine are usually ERCPs.
Correct. Look, if it is a low case, like an ERCP, definitely intubation is the way to go. I think if it's a short case and you could do it just with mild sedation, you may say that, and you could actually, you could have good left-atrial displacement. You may be able to do it with sedation, but I agree, if there's any doubt, if it's a long case, intubation is the way to go to protect their airway. And also not just to protect it in the sense of aspiration, but also it's important to evaluate their airway. And if there's any question about it may be difficult, it's also much better to secure it earlier rather than later, especially in pregnancy where you could have the upper airway swelling. But that's an excellent point then.
And so since we've covered a lot of pre-procedure and procedural considerations, you know, once the endoscopy is done, is there anything that we should bear in mind post-procedurally that we can tell the patient, answer questions? I feel like a lot of them oftentimes ask about breastfeeding, but any thoughts on that?
It's interesting because with breastfeeding after sedation, some people have said that you should wait maybe 6 hours and pump and dump. But then some say that realistically, most of the sedatives used are going to be short acting, they're going to wear off, and you really don't have to change your normal pattern. So I'd be interested to hear David's thought.
No, exactly. Like it used to be not just for sedation, I mean, like also like for general anesthesia, there was always the issue that, oh, you have to pump and dump. But that's not the case. Most of the medications are extremely safe. There's, and I think we quoted in the article, some people say maybe for midazolam, wait 4 hours from the time that you gave it. But even then, you could just wait a little bit. There's no need to pump and dump. So they ought to be aware that if you do it, the closest you do it to the time of the sedation, the baby may be a little bit sleepy. So like that's the, but usually the main issue, the mom needs to be awake, alert, and be able to breastfeed. Like that's probably the most important thing other than no, we have to wait, we have to waste it. There's really not that, and you have to waste it. So it's perfectly safe to breastfeed. But again, the most important thing is awake and alert and able to breastfeed the mother.
So I just want to thank you both. We've had a really great discussion. And it's nice to get the perspective from a gastroenterologist, but also an anesthesiologist on this really important topic. You know, as gastroenterologists, we scope for a living, but we definitely couldn't do it without the sedation. And it's important to have this guidance for this very special population. So Dr. Eppner and Dr. Siddiqui, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us and educating us all.
Thank you very much. It has been a pleasure being here.
It's definitely a team effort, for sure. So thank you.